This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Liverpool and City serve up a treat at Anfield, and ultimately just getting it launched is the way to do it. Cancelo's mistake, Salah's beautiful turn, and a big win for Jurgen Klopp. Did Pep overthink it? Is Haaland a flat track bully? Should Gomez be the England captain? And what can we do about managers embarrassing themselves, barking in the face of officials? Is apologising afterwards enough? Elsewhere, Arsenal are 4 points clear after a slightly fortunate win at Leeds. Feels about the right time to stop every single person you see and ask if now is the time to take the Gunners seriously. Also today, Aston Villa put goals on a plate for Mason Mount, Harry Kane and engineering contact. And as Rashford misses a last-minute header, does that mean Ivan Penalty Tony is even further inside the plane than he was last week? We'll round up the rest of the Premier League and ask just how hot does it get in Leicester in mid-October. All that plus, do goals really need to be the same size? Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Eddie says, forget talk of the best Football Weekly lineup. Surely this is the most perfectly balanced. The playmaker, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
What, am I a playmaker? I always saw myself as, and forgive the pun, as the Mackem Lely, the hard-working graft of the back of midfield.
Yeah, I think so. I would take playmaker. It's, you know,
oh, I'm not knocking
there are
it.
Many playmakers in the squad. Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, basically you are the tactics man. You're really just, yeah, you're just a water carrier. You're the Danny Drinkwater of the pod. The energy, Jordan Jarrett Bryan. Hello, Jordan.
Oh, I love that. Good morning, mate.
The workhorse, Barry Glendenning.
Hello. Yes. First on the training ground up at 5:30 this morning. I'll be last to log off the Zoom call. Then I'll go and practice some free kicks.
Good. Well, for the students of the football podcast genre to enjoy. Let's start then at Anfield. Liverpool 1, Manchester City 0. Richard saying, having lost to a team playing 4-4-2, who scored by their keeper getting it launched, when will Pep adapt to English football? I mean, the decisive moment, the goal, Barry, it is fascinating that between these two teams, it is a long ball and a bit of a mistake and a beautiful bit of skill at the same time.
Yeah, that's the way to beat City. We finally figured it out. Dirty long ball up the middle. Hope for a mistake for the defender and hope that Mo Salah pulls off a wonderful, I suppose it's a pirouette, was it? To turn and go through on goal. It was his second attempt of that nature. Interesting, by the way, or not, as the case may be, Alisson has one goal and three assists to his name in the Premier League, and the three assists have all been for Mo Salah. And I think we saw yesterday that, and in midweek against Rangers, who possibly aren't as good as Manchester City, that a Salah on form makes all the difference to Liverpool. But I must confess, when I saw the lineups for this game and I saw that James Milner was playing right back for Liverpool, I feared for them. And I owe James a huge apology because he was absolutely outstanding, as was Joe Gomez, as was Harvey Elliott, as was Mo Salah, among others. And thoroughly entertaining game, quite chaotic. And weirdly, even though Manchester City lost, I'm still pretty sure they'll win the league at a canter, despite Arsenal's win over Leeds, sending them whatever it is, five points clear now?
Four.
Yeah, but terrific game of football and really narky and tetchy and niggly as well, which is quite nice.
Those Alisson stats sound about as good as Bruno Fernandes' recent form, don't they, with goals and assists. Salah did have a brilliant game, didn't he, Jordan?
He was great. He was great, and he seems to love this fixture, and I think Liverpool love this fixture as well. This the game was actually quite low on quality, I thought, overall. This game normally is quite high on quality. I thought there were a lot of errors, a lot of ball giving away. The better players on the pitch, definitely for City, I don't think had amazing games. I thought Cancelo was really poor, and it took me a while to work out why. I think it was because he was playing as a right back, and I know that he's not, his role has kind of been developed and evolved into an inverted right back, but I thought he had a really, really poor game. as an Arsenal fan, I was watching thinking, who do I want to win this game? Do I want to draw? Do I want Liverpool back in the race for top four? Or do I want City to drop points and become in the title? So I kind of had my Arsenal hat on watching the match. But I think from Liverpool's perspective as well, the right back Milner, if we needed illustrating, reminded us all the strengths and weaknesses of Trent Alexander-Arnold, because he offered nothing going forward for me, Milner, but yet defensively was very, very solid. So I thought, you know, that kind of just, you know, brought up another kind of question about whether how you can develop Alexander-Arnold and whether he can become better defensively. But I thought overall was a really exciting game, if not high in quality.
Milner did have that one break down the right, that cross that just evaded Jota, didn't he? To give him his credit, he did. He bombed forward once. I saw Danny Murphy sort of picking this apart on Match of the Day, Wilson, and sort of saying Manchester City set up differently defensively, sort of leading to, did Pep overthink taking on the team that were 11th in the Premier League?
Yeah, I suspect Pep makes a lot of changes we don't notice when it doesn't go wrong. But when it does go wrong, then you sort of think, well, they've just been playing 4-3-3 and battering everybody all season. What's he fiddling about with? I think the reason must be that he's very conscious of the way you can get at the City is to get in behind the defensive line, to get runners breaking through. And you sort of, even, you know, I think back to that game when Liverpool won the title, the game when City lost to Chelsea to hand them a title. And again, they just got picked off with simple balls over the top. When it goes wrong in the Champions League, even against teams like Lyon, that tends to be how it goes wrong. And you look at what Liverpool's strength is, and it's precisely that sort of running behind your defensive line, quick transitions. So I get why he felt the need to sort of shore up their defences against that. And I think that vulnerability has potentially been heightened by Haaland, because Haaland needs the ball to be played forward quickly. So they're not having time to sort of set themselves in midfield to counter the counter. I assume that's why he did it and went to what was effectively a sort of three at the back with Cancelo pushing up quite high from right back, Foden playing slightly deep on the left as a sort of left winger come wing back. But what actually happened was they were still really open to that ball over the top. Cancelo had by far his worst game of the season, and Foden, who'd absolutely destroyed Milner last season, probably wasn't quite close enough to do the same thing again. And he sort of fell into Harvey Elliott's orbit. So Harvey Elliott was able to sort of bear the brunt of that. And so it wasn't just the goal that was that sort of move, that ball in behind the defence. There was a chance Salah had before that. And then there's those two... Darwin Nunez, whatever was going on in that last 10 minutes. Although I should say, and this is something Ken Early pointed out to me, Darwin Nunez did fail spectacularly and very noisily so that everybody saw him with those two breaks. But in the time he was on the pitch, Erling Haaland touched the ball three times, one of which was the kickoff after the goal, one of which is a defensive header, and one of which is a disappointing header over the bar. Both the big centre-forwards failed in that 15-minute period. Just Haaland failed much more quietly than Nunez failed.
Actually, it's interesting with Haaland, and obviously him not scoring makes people say, look, Joe Gomez and Virgil van Dijk defended him brilliantly, Barry, and they did. But he did have he sort of had chances that he scored this season. He had a header, he had that one sort of from just inside the box where, you know, he was basically as open as he's been in other games. He just didn't score.
Yeah, well, he had six shots. I think he had four on target. You would imagine on any other day he would have got one or two of those goals on target. I seem to think that someone made the point recently that his very presence, even if he doesn't score, just, you know, defenders think too much about where he is and it creates space for other people. And I, watching the game yesterday and highlights again this morning, that didn't seem to be the case with Liverpool. They treated him like a normal striker, you know, not some superhuman striker. And maybe that worked against City. But yeah, he did have chances, but they weren't brilliant chances, but chances you would expect him to score, if not some other commoner garden elite striker.
Jordan?
Watching the game, it felt for me for the first time this season that Manchester City were trying to get him in. They were trying to play to him, whereas before, it looks like they're playing their game and he's just the person that's finishing off the chances. It looked like they were trying really hard to supply him. And I wonder if that had an effect on his game yesterday. It was very obvious that they were trying to put him in, whereas before it looks a little bit more, I don't know, a bit more natural and organic.
I also saw Kevin De Bruyne had a quiet game, and if you can keep him quiet, then by extension, Haaland is probably not going to be as dangerous as usual.
James says, does how the referee decides to referee the game have an influence on VAR, and should it? This is the idea, Wilson, that Anthony Taylor let the game flow, and we all want the game to flow because it makes for a better game. He didn't penalise little fouls, even if by the letter of the law they were fouls. And then we have this little foul or a shirt pull in the build-up to Foden's disallowed goal, and he disallowed that, which seems to me the correct decision.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things there. So one is, this isn't Anthony Taylor's decision. This is the Premier League's decision. And Anthony Taylor is enacting the guidelines given him by the Premier League, which is to allow a little bit more physical contact. The second thing is that that basically means not penalising little shoulder-to-shoulder touches, little pushes, players grappling for the ball. Pulling somebody's shirt isn't that. Pulling somebody's shirt is a foul. There's no way you can pull somebody's shirt and legitimately win the ball. So as soon as you're seen pulling the shirt, it's an offence. And pulling the shirt is something that can be seen very easily on video. It's not subjective. You saw, I mean, it doesn't matter if Fabinho was already going down. It doesn't matter if Anthony Taylor's view initially was blocked. It doesn't matter if it takes the 7th replay to find the angle that shows it clearly. Haaland clearly grabbed Fabinho's shirt and gave him a bit of a tug. That is a foul. It's also just the nature of VAR is there is a stricter liability, de facto, there's a stricter liability in the build-up to goals than there is in open play, because you don't check everything in open play. But in a build-up to goals, yeah, you get penalised for things you might get away with if a goal doesn't result. So it was just obviously the right decision. It would have been an absolute scandal if that had not been given.
Which makes Pep Guardiola's behaviour, and we'll get onto Klopp's, just really frustrating, not just at the time, but afterwards going, oh, this is Anfield. You know, it's just sort of pathetic.
I mean, that's your word, and I'd encourage people not to attack me on social media for the use of the word pathetic. But it's disappointing and counterproductive, and he's just wrong. And you know, we're now led to believe that even had that been permitted, the challenge on Alisson would have been penalised. Now, to be honest, I've only seen sort of 3 or 4 replays of that. I'm not sure to what extent Alisson had the ball under control. I can see why might think that might be dangerous, but like, I haven't really seen it enough to form a firm judgment. But all this idea that this is sort of, you know, it's like Jack Nicholson at the end of Chinatown. Oh, it's Anfield. Like, there's nothing you can do about it. It's Anfield. It's this lawless zone where you're never going to win. Well, let's not forget that the ball only comes to be in that challenge between Fabinho and Haaland from a goal kick, which should have been a corner. There's been a mistake even to give City the goal kick, which leads to what is definitely a foul that the referee then misses because he's on the blind side that VAR then picks up. So the idea there's some monstrous conspiracy that a man sitting in an office in Stockley Park, you know, what, 250 miles from Anfield, is affected by the crowd at Anfield. It's just nonsense. And I don't know, I felt, and I don't know if this is reading too much into it, and it may be, but I wonder if Klopp's comments about the impossibility of competing with nation states, the first time maybe any sort of major manager has really laid that out, whether his comments on Friday rattled Guardiola a bit. Not necessarily in some kind of sense of a pang of conscience that, oh, hang on, who are these people who are funding my great project? But the sense he's kind of playing the Premier League in a slightly easier mode than Klopp. Whether that just sort of niggled him slightly. And then that initial handshake, and the worst form of journalism among many bad forms of journalism is analysing handshakes. But that was quite a frosty handshake before kickoff. And his whole touchline demeanour was of a man expecting a slight. And look, clearly, you know, if coins were thrown at him, that is disgraceful. And whoever threw the coins, they should be identified and prosecuted for it. That's a slightly different issue. But his touchline behaviour, sort of you're waving at the crowd, doing that odd sort of gesture. I mean, quite apart from the sort of public order ramifications, potential ramifications, Does that help Manchester City win that game of football? No. If anything, it does the exact opposite. So, I thought, you know, this has been a rivalry that has not really been characterised by all the nonsense of mind games. And this is the second lowest form of journalism, is talking about press conferences and mind games. But this rivalry hasn't had that, largely. And I do wonder if, perhaps not even deliberately, whether Klopp did get under his skin with those comments on Friday, and that sort of maybe even led to Guardiola's overthinking, if it was overthinking, of a sort of sense, oh, I've got to prove myself, because just putting out all these really expensive, very good players isn't enough. I've got to prove it to me.
Good for you, Wilson, on getting through every lowest form of journalism in one answer, one 15-minute answer. That's
the third lowest form is spending 15 minutes to answer quite a basic question.
Yeah. But like Klopp also, Barry, was pathetic. And like it is, you know, on the weekend where the Merseyside Youth Football League has cancelled all games because of, to raise the awareness about abuse of officials, and the FA are trialling body cams, for him to just sort of bark in the face of that assistant referee, regardless of whether it was a foul or not, it's just embarrassing, and it does have an impact, you know. And some people will go, oh, it's just high passion in the game and it happens. But it just looks so shit.
Well, it is high passion in the game and it does happen, but it shouldn't happen. And it's not a good look to be seen right up in a linesman or fourth official's grill, snarling. We know Jurgen Klopp has it in him, and he got a red card, he deserved it, and he said after the game, in that moment, I snapped, so that is my fault. But, you know, I get that, but it isn't a good look, and presumably he will get a touchline ban, and it's one he deserves.
Yeah, do you think, Wilson, I sort of think football has just lost, dissent has just been lost, and I just don't, it sort of feels like that forever, for the whole time I've been watching, that it's just kind of, that's how it happens. It doesn't happen in other sports, and whenever you try and compare them, people say, oh, they're just different, and you can't compare rugby and cricket and other sports, and, you know, NFL and whatever, but it does seem that football just doesn't have, the dissent law just doesn't exist, you know.
Yeah, and you know, in the same way the Premier League can change its guidelines on how much physical contact is to be permitted, I don't see any reason why the Premier League or UEFA or FIFA can't, from the beginning of next season, say, look, I don't think we want a situation where a player sort of walking backwards from the situation, sort of throwing his arms up, kind of going, oh, come on, and maybe adding a couple of expletives. I don't think that should be penalised. But I think as soon as you make an aggressive move towards a referee, that immediately should be a booking. Anything that vaguely sort of is intimidatory or slows the game down, I just don't understand why you can't enforce that.
Man City, some Mansfield City fans sung hideous things at the Liverpool fans, which is pretty disappointing. Every club has a selection of idiots. It doesn't excuse it, and it's really annoying. On to the 2 o'clock kickoffs. Leeds 0, Arsenal 1. Bukayo says, what's the longest the pod's been delayed due to a power cut? Look, Arsenal 4 points clear after 10 games. The next four games are Southampton, Forest, Chelsea and Wolves. Kieran says, what's the first thing Jordan's going to do when Arsenal win the league?
That's a very good question. I'm going to present Match of the Day or the TalkSport show naked as Gary Lineker did in Leicester.
I think you have to get the Match of the Day gig first before you... Yeah, they're not going to let a man in his pants. They're just not going to let anyone in, are you?
That's a fair point. This was a really bizarre game, but and one that, you know, it was a huge win for Arsenal, especially when you think that City dropped points a couple of hours later. But the thing that's really annoying me, and I've heard Arsenal and non-Arsenal fans say this overnight, and pundits, and I've read some of the papers online today, it was a lucky win. I'm like, how was it a lucky win? The VAR decisions that were enforced were the correct ones. Yep, Leeds were probably more dominant in the second half than Arsenal, but they didn't pepper the Arsenal goal. I don't understand why everyone's kind of saying it was a lucky win.
I mean, they did miss a penalty and had lots of chances.
Well, that's their problem. That's not Arsenal's problem. They had a chance to score, and they didn't. Luck is shooting from 35 yards and getting two deflections and going in. Luck is the referee getting a wrong decision that goes in our favour. That's luck.
No, but luck is coming up against a team who have chances and don't put them away when they could. That is also lucky, right? You dug it out, you played well, but Leeds did play really well in this game. Barry, you had your hand up.
Well, I'm just curious to know. I'm at a loss to know why the Bamford goal was ruled out. And now maybe it was a valid reason, but I'm on
who?
It's
a foul.
Bamford on Gabriel.
I
didn't clock that.
Yeah, I mean, but if there is an angle that shows up properly, look, Bamford's arm goes up, but the angle that they showed on Match of the Day did not show him pushing him. Now, maybe there is an angle that shows it, but for some reason, we haven't been given access to that.
Yeah, well, Dan does say, are VAR's recent interventions in favour of Arsenal evidence of a wide refereeing conspiracy by the PGMOL to deliberately undermine the claims by Arsenal fans of a wide refereeing conspiracy against Arsenal? Oh, okay, we'll go back to the goal, which Saka took brilliantly. I mean, it was a wonderful crossfield ball from Rodrigo, but Saka does finish it brilliantly, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. He had a bit of criticism from the Arsenal fan base earlier this season because he wasn't playing as well as he was last year. I don't agree with that as well. I think he was playing just as well. The only difference now is that it's other players that are chipping in with goals and playing well from an offensive point of view as well. I thought that strike was really, really good. I call it a Batistuta strike. Just really hard, top of the goal, top of back of the net, from an angle that seems to be quite impossible. He's been brilliant. I think he's now in a position whereby for England, I don't see how he cannot start at the World Cup this summer. I think he's been brilliant. I think Arsenal are now etching themselves into a position whereby if they don't get fourth minimum now, that will be a huge implosion. They can't almost not get fourth now. And the next few fixtures you read out there, Max, you know, I don't like using the phrase, you know, they're definite wins, but they're games that you think Arsenal are going to struggle to lose those games. So if they can go to the World Cup with a nice cushion at the top of the league, they will be etching towards guaranteeing top four spot in the league this season.
I find it interesting, Jordan, that the vibe you're giving is it's all about top four finish rather than winning.
Yep. And a lot of my friends are saying I'm being a bit of a wimp by not saying we should go for the league because PTSD. I've been burned before, Max, Barry. So there's an element of that. But also, I just didn't need to stick to the plan. The big annoyance for me last year was that the plan was always top four. And then when we didn't get top four, people were kind of saying, oh, we should have done a whole lot more, rare. I'm saying this year, the plan is top four. Let's secure top four as soon as possible. And then from that point, if we can get third or second, great. I'm just being a bit too sensible maybe, but for me it's still let's secure top four ASAP and then see if we can get as close to City, who I think will win the league, as possible. Do you think I'm being a bit of a wimp, Barry, by not
going? Well, I mean, you're 4 points clear, you're playing as well as you have in years since, you know, peak Wenger probably, and yeah, just settling for fourth seems a bit
And yet, at the same time, you've just described an away game at Chelsea as very winnable. The sort of game we should win.
Well, yeah, I reckon that Chelsea is really good, actually. So that's a game where, I would, in our current form, I would expect to draw at least there. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, he's backing down already.
He'll take fifth. By the end of the pod, he'll take eighth, won't he? How do you assess Arsenal, Wilson?
They've been excellent. I think it's just a real shame. Shame for Arsenal and a shame for me and general sort of neutral watchers that the game against City on Wednesday's been postponed. That they're playing PSV.
Because of...
So the game against PSV was postponed because of the Queen, is that right?
Yes, I think so.
So they have to play that PSV game, so we don't have... I mean, it would have been good, wouldn't it? A confident Arsenal against a Pep who's starting to fray. That would have been... I mean, can you not just give PSV the points? Let us watch that.
But for the neutral, it's really disappointing, I'm sure. But for Arsenal, it's a massive help that fixture has now been kicked down the road.
No. Now you're in form and they're starting to question it. Now's the time to play them.
Maybe my wimp side's coming out, Wilson. Here. I want to bank as many points as possible before we play them.
You do have to play them at some point, I think, Jordan. It is worth mentioning, Barry, that the last minute incident where Bamford and Gabriel just had a sort of hilarious pushing, kicking, falling over, red card, penalty overturned. I mean, it must have been very frustrating as a Leeds fan, but I think probably the right result in that one.
Yeah, the Lord gave it to Leeds and then the Lord took it away. It was a peculiar incident, and I suppose it's a good job that they did get VAR working in there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even if it took 40 minutes. I'm not sure how that affected travelling Arsenal fans. Were they able to get home? I don't know, but it just shows how beholden the game has become to video assistant refereeing, and it was needed in that game on several occasions.
It was. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Villa Park. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Aston Villa 0, Chelsea 2. I presume then, Jordan, Chelsea weren't lucky in this game, even though Tyrone Mings, 50p head, and Emi Martinez just jumping out the way of a football basically gave Chelsea two goals in a game that otherwise Villa dominated.
Listen, I thought Villa were a bit unlucky in this game. I thought Villa played quite well for large parts of this match and gave Chelsea a good run for their money. My thoughts on Steven Gerrard, Max, are... as there have always been, I've always had this fear and concern that he's the sort of manager that you want in the dressing room at half-time when you're 2-1 down or 1-0 down to give a rousing, tub-thumping, and maybe I'm being a little unfair here, but this is kind of the impression I get, a tub-thumping speech to kind of get you back out there, pumped up, fired up, and you win the game, you know, you turn it around from 1-0 down to 2-1 winners. I've always had concerns about how tactically astute and tactically intelligent he is, and I think over the course of the season this year that's kind of coming to fruition in terms of what I think about him as a manager. And this was another game where I'm still not quite sure what a Steven Gerrard Aston Villa team is.
What are they, Wilson?
Well, I mean, he plays that 4-3-2-1, which he played a lot at Rangers as well, and I think that last couple of months at Rangers you started to see it, that it does mean you lack a bit of width, and it does, I think, make you a bit predictable. And you're very reliant on a player like Coutinho or Buendia to do something brilliant to unlock opponents. So I think that's their problem, that they're just a bit obvious going forward, and Premier League teams have sort of worked them out. Now, having said that, they had plenty of chances against Chelsea, and Kepa made two or three absolutely outstanding saves, so they easily could have won that game. And then you have a whole Ming situation that Gerrard seemed to want him out, and now he's because of the injury to
Carlos.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I can see how that error for the first goal happened, that the ball was spinning, and yeah, you don't have to get that. It's a fractional mistake, and because of a spin on the ball, and then of course because things are going wrong for him, it goes straight to Mount, and it's an easy goal. And then the free kick, Does it take a deflection or not? I still haven't worked it out.
No, it doesn't.
So I think Martinez moves his body, and the ball dips quite a lot, but it does look really ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I only saw it, I don't know, two or three times, and the first time I thought it must be a deflection. The second time I thought, oh, there's no deflection. And the third time I thought, actually, the way it's gone over the wall, there's something quite odd about that trajectory. But that trajectory still doesn't explain what Martinez is doing. So I was one of Villa's better performances this season, but I think they're one of those teams who probably are better against better sides. And you know, in the same way that they held City to a draw, the nature of that very narrow formation is they're quite good at restricting opponents, but they just lack a bit of spark themselves and a little bit. I mean, are they the second lowest scorers in the division after Wolves, I think?
Yeah, and we can't count Wolves, really.
Well, it's that whole sort of...
With goal scoring.
I mean, it's that whole actually, West Neil Midlands goal drought, isn't it? It's kind of... the problem is all the goals in the Midlands have gone to the East Midlands, to Leicester. I know they're wasting that as well, and the West Midlands is struggling desperately. That's why we need redistribution of goals across the Midlands.
Interesting. I was listening to Neil Taylor, former Villa fullback, saying, and when you say the lack of width, and I think I've said this before, but Villa Park is massive. Like, as pitches go, it's really big. So width is really quite important on a really big pitch, and perhaps Steven Gerrard should realise that the pitch that he plays most his games on is big. You mentioned it as well, Wilson, but Barry, Kepa was just ridiculous in this game, some of these saves.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was as good as I've seen Villa play this season, and yet this pod has the air about it of one where we might finish recording and then discover that either or both of Steven Gerrard and Jesse Marsh have been sacked and you have to do a voice note when...
God, Brendan Rodgers has got lucky there, Baz.
I forgot about him. But yeah, and fair play to Kepa, because he was a bit of a laughing stock. He came in with this massive price tag. It wasn't working out for him. They couldn't get rid of him because he was too expensive. But he has come in, displaced Edouard Mendy now, and Mendy's going to have a job getting back in the side because he wasn't playing particularly well. He did get injured, did he? Before he was dropped. He wasn't just dropped. But Kepa was outside. He made some one astonishing save yesterday, or two. And fair dues.
And he has incredibly... quite a deep voice, but he has really profound eyebrows. In about 50 years, he could look a little bit like Norman Lamont. That's something to look out for. If you're really playing the long game with this podcast, let's go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Spurs 2, Everton 0. Spurs have 23 points from 10 games, same as Man City, their highest tally at this stage of a Premier League season. The enforced change of shape, Wilson, really helped them, didn't it? When Richarlison got injured, and we hope he's okay for the World Cup, and Bissouma came on, it really helped.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally there's been a sense that when Spurs play that front three, they're a little bit short in midfield. And I think that sort of 3-4-3 formation that Conte has favoured, and not just at Spurs, but I think that is the danger of that formation. I think particularly the game at Arsenal, there was a sense that Spurs were... I know the intention then was to sit deep and strike on the break, but they sort of were probably forced more into the back foot than they'd wanted to be in that game. So yeah, the extra midfielder. I mean, I thought they were on top from the start, to be honest. But yeah, it did give them a greater sort of incision when they got the extra midfielder and they were able to control it a bit more through there.
Yeah, I mean, I think they did control it. Everton did have two good chances in the first half, which Frank Lampard was pretty disappointed about. Andrew says, are we all going to pretend Kane didn't die for the penalty because he's the England captain?
I think he may have gamed the system there, but I thought it was absolutely a penalty, and I thought Jordan Pickford was quite lucky not to get a red card because he made no attempt whatsoever to play the ball.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a penalty and also a dive if you're allowed to have those. Well, not a dive, but like his body starts to crumple. But, you know, Pickford certainly gave him the opportunity by spilling the ball in the first place, didn't he? Man United 0, Newcastle 0. Is there anything more satisfying than a Ronaldo tantrum? Nathan says, what does the panel think was the most difficult task for Ronaldo to perform on Sunday evening while still shaking his head? Driving his car home, getting his dinner fork to his mouth, or brushing his teeth? To be fair,
well,
though...
brushing your teeth, it would help.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. You could just keep the hand still, couldn't you? I mean, he probably wasn't would have scored that chance that Rashford missed in the last minute.
Probably, but... I mean, yeah, the argument last season was always, but he scores you goals. Even if he doesn't actually move anymore, even if he doesn't do any pressing, he scores you goals. And he got, 18 in the Premier League last season, was it? Ah, now he just looks like an old man. Every now and again, you see a flicker of what he once was, but he's a really sort of lumbering presence now. This isn't the first time we've seen it this season. And you sort of think, oh, well, maybe he just lacks a bit of game time. He just needs to... Yeah, his sharpness will come. But I think maybe this is the end for him.
It is a shame Rashford didn't score that header, Barry, mainly because the Casemiro cross was so Modric-inspired, we could have talked about it for hours. But because the goal didn't go in, we can't talk about
it. Yeah, well, you can. It was still a good cross. But I think it's a shame on a number. I think this game needed one or other side to win. You know, so if Rashford had scored that header, United would have won, and it would have been a slap down for this emerging evil empire who'd just been beaten by the impoverished church mice of Manchester United. Or if, you know, say Callum Wilson had got the penalty when he was fouled by Varane, and the penalty he should have got but didn't. I know there were other dubious penalty decisions, but, and Newcastle had won, then it would have been, you know, a statement win for the emerging evil empire against the former evil empire that was Manchester United. But so yeah, I was hoping for a winner of this game one way or the other, and to see it just finish as a 0-0 draw was a bit disappointing.
Who finishes higher, do we think, out of United, the two Uniteds?
Ooh, I mean, I'd probably say Manchester United. Haven't they got a better squad? They've got a deeper squad. Ten Hag should get things moving. He'll work out who fits where. Casemiro will pick up. It obviously depends what happens in January, doesn't it, with Newcastle. But I wouldn't put my house on Manchester United finishing higher than Newcastle. And my wife would be very confused as to why we were selling the house. that was the case. but that would be my thought. I don't know, Wilson, if you have any advances on that.
Yeah, I think it's probably still... there's still the potential for Manchester United to collapse completely. I don't think they will, but it's not totally impossible. And it's still probably one season too early for Newcastle. So I think Manchester United are probably going to finish fourth or fifth. And I think Newcastle probably finish sixth or seventh.
It was a good moment where Joe Linton became 2019 Joe Linton again with those two headers that just sort of hit the woodwork. You just sort of thought back to glory, his glory days. It's worth chatting a bit about Kieran Trippier, given the injuries to Reece James, who he's tweeted that, you know, never give up or words to that effect, but may well be out of the World Cup. Kyle Walker is back from injury and is coming back from injury, but a lot of rehab to do. He may not make it as well. So, you know, after the glut of right backs, we now have no right backs. and you sort of think Kieran Trippier would pretty much a shoo-in then, Wilson.
Yeah, he should be. And I mean, it's good that England have four, if you include Alexander-Arnold, who obviously came off the bench late on yesterday. But yeah, Trippier's dead ball delivery, I think, is a key asset. So it's I think Reece James is arguably at the minute on form England's best footballer. So to lose him is a terrible blow. And I don't see any sense in taking a half fit player to a major tournament.
It has not worked in England's favour in the past.
Yeah. I mean, the only good news is that it would allow me to dust off previous pieces about why England should never take half-fit players. Pontifications on why Kevin Keegan should never have gone to Spain in 1982. If Trippier becomes the first choice right wing back, you've also got to look at who's going to play on the right of the back three. And Joe Gomez, thankfully, suddenly looks like a proper footballer again, and he could do that. Or Ben White, I guess, is the other option to fill in there. And because I don't know how bad John Stones' injury is, whether he's going to be fit again. But at least there are candidates in those positions where, you know, Harry Kane gets injured. Ivan Toney is clearly a good player, but he has nothing like the same depth of experience.
He has nothing like it. But why don't we talk about Ivan Toney to finish part two? Brentford beat Brighton 2-0. He makes penalties beautiful, Jordan, doesn't he?
He does. He does. Cliche, makes him look very, very, very easy. And I've heard a lot of people saying that he should be going to the World Cup with England just on penalties alone, which I think is a little bit of a stretch. I don't endorse that. I'm a big fan of Ivan Toney. I wanted him at Arsenal. I wanted us to sign this summer. If we were to let Eddie Nketiah go, which we didn't, I think he's a really underrated striker that I think could go to a level above Brentford. And I think the way he plays, I don't think he's world-class or, you know, amazing, but I think he's very good at everything. He's strong, his hold-up play is good, his inside-the-box finishing is good, outside the box, I think his link-up play is good. In the air, he's a threat. I think he's got a bit of skill and a trick in him as well. And I'd be surprised if Brentford keep hold of him next time. I think in this game, I thought he terrorised Brighton. I don't think Brighton could handle him. And he was everything that I think on the opposite side of the fence in terms of their squad. Danny Welbeck, I think, was supposed to be. Didn't quite live up to the player that I think he was going to be. But no, I'm a big fan of his. And I thought he's knocking on the door hard now for Southgate to pick him and take him on the plane.
Although to be fair to Welbeck, I think he's been brilliant for Brighton and has sort of kind of had a bit of a renaissance. But you know, Tony has that mentality. The thing about the penalties, Wilson, is...
Well, Welbeck had loads of injuries as well, didn't he?
Yeah, that is true. But the thing about the penalties with Tony is just not looking at the ball at all. I can't think of that many players who have done that. And I'm maybe putting you on the spot and you could just tell me about a Hungarian from the 30s. But like anybody who's played to any terrible level knows a real key part of kicking the ball is to be looking
well,
at it.
So let me tell you about
it.
Blind Gyula Kovacs, the...
Well, I think Tony explained it after the game. He sort of made the point, the ball doesn't move, the goal doesn't move. So you don't need to look at... you just need to look at the goalkeeper.
This is true, but why? And you know this, Barry, because you're having golf lessons. They tell you to look at the ball all the time, not to lift your head and watch where it's gone down the fairway, but to keep your head down looking at the ball. A golf ball doesn't move. It sits on a tee or on the fairway. So... If it's the right thing to do in golf to keep looking at the ball, why is it not the right thing to do with a penalty? I suppose in golf you're not trying to put the ball past the goalkeeper, but
I'm quite early into my
something for Liv Tour to look into.
My golf career. I mean, I played a bit as a kid, but it's all about the technique. So ideally, you would pretend the ball isn't there. See, it's all about the swing and the technique.
But are you not meant to be watching the ball the whole time?
Well, yes. But say even if you're taking a practice swing, you watch where the ball isn't. But it's all about the swing, the technique.
Who's teaching you golf, Barry? How long into the round do you pretend the ball? Do you pretend the ball isn't there for the whole round?
Well, the thing is, it's a lot easier when the ball isn't there. But you know, you're doing your practice swings, whatever, and then on the range. And then someone puts this white thing down on a tee, and it's like you have a mental disintegration.
Anyway, it's a great skill for Ivan Toney. Brighton's still looking for their first win under De Zerbi, and they're playing nice football. They've played well in the games that he's been in charge. Had a lot of the ball, played nice stuff.
It's just textbook Brighton, but he looked so disappointed afterwards. I think that was when the penny dropped. Oh, God, I'm managing Brighton and they just cannot bloody score. I mean, they got 3 goals in his first game in charge. That presumably got his hopes up, but they've completely reverted to type. And I actually thought they were the better team in this game. But again, failings in front of goal have cost them. It's a big problem.
Yeah, and it's not really his... Is it his fault? Like, Solly March had such a straightforward header that he has to put in the corner. That's not De Zerbi's fault, is it? You know, it's a bit like Steven Gerrard. It's not really his fault if Tyrone Mings heads it the wrong way, is it?
There is only so much the manager can do.
Right. Anyway, that'll do for part 2. Part 3, we'll do the rest of the Premier League games. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Fulham 2, Bournemouth 2. This was an excellent game. Bournemouth, I think, Wilson, Bournemouth should be slightly disappointed they didn't get all 3 points in this game.
Yeah, probably. I mean, the change in that club since Scott Parker left has been incredible. And I know this sometimes, I mean, it certainly has happened to Southampton, that you get beat 9-0. It even happened to the Crystal Palace in...
1990.
When was it? 89-90. That it's almost like a battering like that is a reset button, and you sort of, I mean, clearly you could just collapse, but I think for a lot of teams it's sort of, you go back to basics and you go back to doing the simple things well. I mean, and obviously in this case they did brought in a new manager, and I think that's what Bournemouth are doing, and yeah, to have the lead like that and then to chuck it away, that has not been the way that they've played under Gary O'Neill. So, I mean, a draw was not a scandalous result, but yeah, they probably will be annoyed, and yeah, they've since that 9-0 defeat, have they taken the third most points, I think, of teams in the Premier League?
Certainly unbeaten, you know, since then. Do you think it makes Scott Parker look a little bit ridiculous with his comments, or do you think that reset may well have happened anyway?
Is Scott Parker in danger of maybe being seen as the problem? Because both these clubs, since he's left, and albeit at Bournemouth, it's a very short sample size of time, seem to have got better. I've got lots of Fulham fans that have said that the minute he left Fulham, it just got better. The vibe and the energy around the club got better, and they were better off without him. And I just wonder if he's not careful, unintentionally, he may position himself as the problem in a really weird way at clubs. I don't know.
Well, you're bringing it all back to the fact that you can't really put Gary O'Neill's post-match or Marco Silva's post-match to the streets. And because of that, the vibe that Scott Parker eventually gives off is just this really depressing, dry your eyes, mate, regardless of whatever's happened. And he just can't get away from that. The penalty that Mitrovic won from Jefferson Lerma was another one of these. West Ham didn't get one this week. They did get one last week. This kind of grappling in the box that was felt like really a big thing about 4 years ago. And then we all forgot about it. And now we're remembering about it.
Yeah, well, I thought that was a penalty. I also thought Bournemouth should have had two penalties that they didn't get. Both, I think, a Tim Ream handball and a Tim Ream pullback on Ryan Fredericks. And I was surprised they weren't given. But overall, I thought draw was probably fair. Bournemouth's, I'm not sure if anyone else noticed, but Bournemouth's opener, where they just cut through the Fulham defence, Tavernier, Billing and Solanke, it was straight out of the Man City playbook, you know, the pullback and then the sweep home, first touch. So I was quite impressed with that.
Wolves beat Nottingham Forest 1-0 in the build-up to this defeat. Forest's official Twitter account posted a mock-up picture of striker Emmanuel Dennis sat on the pitch at the City Ground with three Wolf cubs, calmly sat with him with the caption "Playtime." The post was subsequently deleted, but not before Ruben Neves had forwarded it to the Wolves squad. Wilson, I don't quite see how this should really motivate the squad any more than being paid like a horrendously large amount of money to do your job, to be motivated to be a footballer. Like, you can't be like, I'm not that arsed about this game, but now I've seen Emmanuel Dennis with some Wolf cubs, I really fucking want it.
I just don't. I mean, I'm just an old man. I don't understand any of this social media nonsense. Like, I mean, if Emmanuel Dennis has taken, I don't know how long that would take. Photographers always seem to take ages to do what seems like quite basic tasks for me, but say that took half an hour of his day, 15 minutes maybe, if they'd set up all the lighting and everything first. Like, wouldn't he have been better just practicing penalties for 15 minutes? I don't think they got
actual Wolf cubs, did they? I think they just got a photo.
Well, they got actual wolves in for Diego Costa's presentation, and he was terrified.
He said to pose for the photo, didn't he?
Well, I guess so, yeah. I don't
and know. Then Wolves responded after the final whistle with a picture of a tree stump and an axe in it.
Yeah. And I actually thought an axe was probably a bit too far. Like some secateurs with some gentle pruning might have been enough. It didn't really feel like they completely tore Forest apart, did they?
Sort of like some very old tree with like Dutch elm disease or something. Just sort of slowly fading with a slightly weak man sort of leaning on it, just nudging it the last little bit.
Southampton 1, West Ham 1. Andy says, does Barry know what to make of Ralph Hasenhüttl? Yeah, I can't have that conversation again. I mean, the most fun part of this game, Barry.
My takeout from this game is be afraid, West Ham fans. Be very afraid. Because as a Republic of Ireland fan, I have seen Declan Rice kiss the crest, kiss the badge before. And we all know how that ended up. So, yeah, good. A good point for West Ham. They should have won. They were robbed, I think. But Yeah, Declan Rice will be on his way in jig time. Probably January, because he's given it the badge. Oh, that hurt. that brought up some horrible memories.
Did you think they'll be robbed because the referee, was it Peter Banks, was in the way of Jared Bowen for Southampton's goal?
Yeah, he was clearly in the way. Now, I thought the laws of the game were the ref is part of the pitch. That, you know, that's how we understand it. So if he gets in the way or the ball hits him or he blocks a shot, that's just tough and unfortunate. But I think Danny Murphy or Martin Keown, Match of the Day, seem to suggest that getting in the way, he's entitled to stop the game and have a drop ball or whatever.
No, I think...
But he did. He clearly got in the way.
Yeah, but I think, and this is... I wrote a column about pundits not knowing the laws of the game, so hopefully we should know the laws of the game. But you're allowed to say you don't know. I think letter of the law, if it touches you, you have to stop the play. Unless there was a moment, I think, in Liverpool City where it hit the ref and it went straight to... It went where it was going. It might not have been in that game, but like, so the ref can play on there. But because it didn't touch him, he didn't have to stop the play. But it did... I could see why David Moyes was annoyed, but look, the referee has to be somewhere. It's really unlucky. And then for it to get deflected and go in, the ref's got to be annoyed. To go, oh no, I've got to give this goal. I don't know. Jordan, what do you think?
I tend to think more inside of where Barry's coming from, just kind of get on with it, really. I understood it as if it touches the referee, it's to his discretion whether he stops play, does a bounce ball, or he carry on. That's how I understood it. So, but again, I don't know the rule there, so I'm not going to pretend to your column that I do know that particular rule.
And, you know, it's a drop ball, not a... What's a bounce ball? This is not basketball. This is a bounce ball. What are you even doing here? It's ridiculous. Scamacca looks like a brilliant player. I thought, you know, he had one shot from about 70 yards that whistled wide, and he just looks like a lot of fun. Finally, Leicester 0... Crystal Palace 0. Brendan Rodgers said, you can see the players are running and fighting. They ran themselves into the ground today. It was a hot day as well for them, but they pressed the game. They kept fighting. So he didn't really say it was sweltering, did he? But it was 16 degrees in Leicester. That game, it wasn't a good game of football. Barry, you stopped halfway through to clean your bathroom.
Yeah, I watched the first half and it wasn't doing it for me. So I went and cleaned my bathroom for the second half. It didn't take me like 45 minutes to clean my bathroom, but I had other domestic chores to attend to.
But this is the real problem of a Winter World Cup, isn't it? That we have now a ludicrous spectacle of people being forced to play football in Leicester in October when they should be playing in December and January.
Do you think Brendan Rodgers will turn it around? Do you think he'll have the time to turn it around?
Leicester's owner looked pretty fed up.
It's a question that slightly directs you down an avenue that I think is not useful. I don't think time is really the issue. I think the owners are absolutely desperate for him to turn it around because they don't have to pay him off. So I think Rodgers would have quite happily negotiated a settlement earlier in this season. And the owners are sort of forcing him to stay on.
So he'll get the time. He just doesn't have the inclination to turn things around.
It's a bit like Christian Fuchs, who I'm sure they held against his will for about 4 years. Yeah. Brendan Rodgers now just being held against his will at Leicester.
But I mean, the problem is that morale is clearly pretty low. And maybe that point that Rodgers made about them running and working, maybe that is the beginning of that sort of bottoming out and coming out the other side. But when they've lost Fofana, they've got all their... I mean, has Ryan Bertrand ever played a game for Leicester? He's just always injured.
I mean, he's a Southampton player in my mind, so thank you for letting me know.
Pereira's still injured. They just have these... I mean, Johnny Evans was out again, wasn't he, with injury? They have these perennial injuries which at the back, which don't help.
And players coming in, they're not good enough.
I mean, Vardy kind of clearly is now behind Patson Daka in the... in the pecking order, and he's starting to show his age. So I just think there's sort of been this sort of, a number of things have come together at Leicester that there's two or three pretty poor teams in the Premier League. They might be able to clamber above, but they maybe the World Cup can be a reset for them.
It's interesting you say that. I tweeted after the Leicester Palace game that one interesting thing about this Premier League season is there aren't any really noticeable standout terrible teams. and Leicester fans, Forest fans, Southampton fans, and Villa fans all got in touch with me to say, "Whoa, well, hang on a second, no, there really are some really terrible teams this season."
What about Wolves? Wolves not.
They were all asleep. They're just so bored. Nuno might be back, so that'll wake them up. Real Madrid beat Barcelona 3-1 in El Clasico, Barca's first league defeat of the season. Real go top, so a bit of a issue for Barcelona because they look likely to drop out of the Champions League. PSG beat Marseille 1-0. Mbappe set up Neymar and then said he never said he was unhappy. So yeah, it's one to watch, isn't it? James says, "I'd love some reflection on the 4 red cards, 6 goals, missed penalty and overall chaos at Bramall Lane this weekend, please, folks." We're going to do an EFL special tomorrow, so we'll keep our powder dry on that. Craig says, "Surely you have to mention this guy." This is a tweet from Fearless in Devotion, the Wrexham podcast. "I wanted to know more about this Blythe fan, John the Toaster. Niall Bromley gave me some context. There is a Blythe fan called John the Toaster who goes to games with a toaster on his head and he plugs it in at random bars at away games and makes people toast. So he's John the Toaster." Good for him. Ben says, "What is this on Streatham Common? My son just hit it playing Paul Scholes, which is a game where you hit a tree from distance, all based on the Ronaldo quote. I saw this, and it is a bollard on Streatham Common that says, 'On this spot, on the 12th of May 2004, Jonathan Wilson inverted his first pyramid. Hashtag the long throw trail. Wilson.'"
Yeah, somebody forwarded me a photo of this a few months ago. I don't really understand what it is.
It's like a blue plaque for you.
Yeah, but I mean, my understanding was you needed to be dead to get a blue plaque, and I certainly feel moderately alive.
Yeah. So maybe people think because you keep doing the same Ronaldo column, it's like Weekend at Bernie's, and they're just pretending we're all pretending you're alive, and actually these are just we've just cut and paste some other podcasts from you.
What's the Streatham connection?
Oh, I don't know.
So you didn't? No part of inverting the pyramid was written in Streatham.
Nope.
All right. Okay. Well,
I'm not even sure I've ever been to Streatham.
Ah. Well, you should feel incredibly honoured. I'm slightly jealous.
Well, I mean, because I think it's sort of, is it a, like, it's a walking route, I think, isn't it? This long throw trail, and there's other sort of spoof blue plaques on that trail. But who put them up, or when, or why, I have no idea.
I'm going to have to go and inspect.
Yeah.
Because until now, Streatham was my least favourite of my local comedy.
I mean, it's just one sticker on a bollard, Barry. I mean, it's not going to make a huge difference, I think. Although, if you want to suggest what the blue plaques could be for the rest of the pod, footballweekly@theguardian.com. Come to the live show for Barry's favourite commons, says producer Joel. Yeah, there is a live show. I'll tweet about it. I think there are a few tickets still available at Earth in Hackney, theguardian.com/guardianlive. Me, Ellis James, Lars Siverton, Barry, special guests, etc., etc. Yes, Jordan?
Sorry, if you'll allow me to just go back to my pirate radio days and give a shout out to a loyal listener to the pod. Yes. Who I bumped into the Apple store last week, who said, he said to me, "I'm a huge fan. And because I'm incredibly arrogant, I'm going to assume he was talking about me, not so much the pod." Right. But he said he loves the pod. And I wanted to give him a shout out because he said he loves the pod. So that's my.
Did you get his name?
I didn't. But it was a lovely young man, white, 6 foot.
Okay.
With an
now you sound like a newsreader who says, "Please avoid this person." You know, he was wearing a grey hoodie, and he should not be approached on any account. And he was listening to the pod while he committed the crime. Well, you've done your shout out, so that is great. You didn't do it in a very pirate radio way. I mean, I was expecting it sort of need to be a bit more shouty, Jordan.
I don't want to go too Brixton on it because I think this is not the forum for that sort of tone.
You're suggesting he should have done it with a dagger between his teeth while climbing some webbing.
No, it's just my knowledge of pirate radio is when you're driving along and you're listening to the radio and then another radio station comes in and people just shout very quickly and it's very noisy and I want them to go away. A bit like in the old days when the travel news from local radio used to come in. Does that still happen? You're driving along and then the travel news comes in from local radio? Because when I was at local radio, I had control of that button. And we used to just press the button and tell people to listen to our radio show. Or we'd press the button and yell, look out. And I didn't realize that this is illegal. That was a very bad thing to do. So my apologies, but you know, that's how zany I was on BBC Radio Cambridgeshire. Look, that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks, Max.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. EFL Pod tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.